Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with award-winning photographer Marcia Keegan. I'm very happy now to welcome Aisha Khan. She's a filmmaker. She produced the film Made in Pakistan, which we talked to her about recently on the Radio Cafe. And she's here today to talk about the flooding in Pakistan. Welcome, Aisha, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you back. Now, the flood in Pakistan that happened a few weeks ago is bigger than the earthquake in Haiti, than the tsunami, than the earthquake in Pakistan 5 years ago.
Yes.
Nobody knows about it.
Yeah, and that's why I'm here, so that we can start actually putting some exposure to this issue, because we are getting very, very, very worried.
What's happening? What, first of all, what is the magnitude of this flood?
The magnitude of the flood, basically, at this point, is that a third of the country, landmass-wise, is underwater.
One-third of Pakistan is underwater?
One-third of Pakistan has been affected. Most of the areas are very severely affected, and then there's the outer laying kind of areas which are moderately affected. However, we don't even know the extent of it, because it's been 3 weeks now since these rains have been pouring and the flooding has started, and there are some areas which are so remote that people have not been able to access them yet. So the numbers that are coming out that there's only 1,600 dead, we don't know that number is true or not. We have no idea.
Right.
Because these places, the bridges are gone, the roads are gone. There's no accessibility at all, except by helicopter.
Now, one of the things that is very difficult in this situation is that not only is are a lot of villages completely wiped out, but even those who survived okay, a lot of agricultural land is gone. So there's insufficient food, and the remaining food is very expensive.
Yeah, there's not enough food. A lot of the wheat crop is gone, which is a staple for Pakistan. And literally, the numbers are rising so rapidly, we don't even know how to fathom them. The UN has announced that 20 million people have been displaced. Okay, so when we talk...
20 million people.
That number was 14 million 4 days ago. And Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, of course, was there 2 days ago and literally looked visibly shaken. The footage that I saw of his, and he said he has never seen anything like this before.
And no Pakistanis have seen anything like this.
None
before.
Of us. This is, we haven't seen flooding like this. I think the last flood, which could kind of be seen as, you know, having this effect, was 1929. So we were not prepared. Nobody,
right.
I mean, who's prepared?
Well, who
we
can
weren't
be prepared,
prepared
for a third of your country
yeah.
going underwater?
I mean, we weren't prepared in this country for Katerina.
Right.
And one of the things that somebody pointed out, why we are not seeing that immediate response from the world for donations and stuff is, they pointed this out to me, that when an earthquake happens, whether it's Haiti or Pakistan, it's like a heart attack. And it's quick and it's swift, and then you're dealing with the aftermath. And he said the flooding is like a cancer. And it's just going to spread. And that's what we're seeing now. The number of displaced literally is growing by the millions every single day. And there are wonderful relief agencies who are on the ground right now, UNHCR, Mercy Corps, Oxfam. They are appealing through their, you know, blogospheres, their emails, their media contacts, that we need aid now. But what we are really worried about is that this country, especially America, the U.S. networks are not carrying the news enough.
Well, that's a big problem. I mean, you did a, or one of your associates did a media analysis in which you compared the amount of media coverage in Haiti, of the earthquake in Haiti, to the media coverage of the Pakistan flood.
Exactly. And what he found out was that in the first 2 weeks of Haiti earthquake happening, there were 88 stories in the New York Times, as opposed to 15 on Pakistan right now. And it's been 3 weeks. The other analysis he did was that the cover story of Haiti being the cover story for the New York Times was about 12 in the first 2 weeks. We've only had one.
Right, and it's that kind of media coverage that gets people galvanized to
Absolutely.
Make donations and to help.
Absolutely.
They've raised hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't know what happened to them. That's another program. But
right.
for the
Haiti.
Earthquake.
Yeah,
in Haiti.
They did. And at this point, the situation is desperate. I mean, it really is. So what I want to talk about is what me and a couple of fantastic women out of New York and D.C. have done to start raising the image of this disaster in this country. And that is this organization called Relief for Pakistan. Relief, the number 4, Pakistan. It's a website. You can go and find it.
.com.
You can find it, Google it. We have a Facebook page. And what we've decided to do is raise $100,000 for Mercy Corps. Because Mercy Corps has been very active in Pakistan. They've been very active during the earthquake. They have a huge infrastructure and they're very transparent.
Mercy Corps, what kind of things have they done in the past?
They've been on every mega disaster there is. Okay, they're very, very internationally well-known and very well-known in this country. But they have an incredible infrastructure in Pakistan right now on the ground. So we decided to just put the funding towards one company right from the get-go so that they can have a much bigger impact than, you know, just giving little funds to everyone. So for now, our goal is $100,000. We started the website, I think August 13th is when it came online, and we've already raised $26,000 today.
Excellent. So, ladies and gentlemen, you can go to relief4pakistan.com. The number 4 is the, what's in the middle of that, relief4pakistan.com. So this is an area, I mean, it's a, you know, when people think of villages, they think of a group of small buildings that are, you know, maybe a little bit precarious. I mean, this is a huge area of villages, cities, a major middle class, millions of people who have lost everything.
The farmers who are bread and butter. That's what they are. I mean, we are a huge agricultural country. It's gone. It's literally been swept away. It's biblical proportion in order to put it in context for anybody. And in fact, if you're not seeing images of it in the media right now, I would tell you to go to the Boston Globe, boston.com, I think it is.
Yeah.
They did an incredible pictorial on the ravages and the flood and cattle floating and these poor people literally trying to save one, you know, cow so that they'll have something left. It's incredible.
Now, this is where you're from. This is where your family is from.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually from a very tribal part of Pakistan, Balochistan. But it's a huge landmass. The reports I'm getting from there is that nobody has been there yet. We actually cannot access it because the roads and the bridges are gone.
Now, have you spoken to family and friends?
Yes, thank God. All of our family is in the urban areas in Lahore. So they are trying to get together donations and what have you and, you know, start making the trek out there. But literally, it's inaccessible.
We're talking to Aisha Khan about Pakistan and the flooding that's going on there now. Why do you think the media coverage has been so poor here in the U.S.?
You know, we're really shocked because if we look at the political, you know, dimensions to this and the war on terror that we've been fighting for the last 10 years, we are the front line for America. Pakistan is the front line. And
What do you mean when you say that?
It's literally the Pakistani army, which is fending off whoever we call these Taliban coming in from the Afghanistan side into Pakistan and taking refuge. And the same people who are, you know, dealing and what we consider fighting the American army in Afghanistan, right? So we're on the side of America. And yet, which is what Made in Pakistan kind of addressed, is the media coverage in this country always about Pakistan is that it's the most dangerous country in the world. That's it. Blanket, you know, whitewash everything else. And as you saw, Made in Pakistan addressed that.
Yeah, the film that was in the Santa Fe Film Festival last winter, which was a wonderful film about basically following the lives of several middle-class people in the city of Lahore in Pakistan, whose lives are remarkably like basically any urban dweller in any city in the world.
And that was the whole point of it, to show that, listen, yes, terrorism is a problem in Pakistan, but we are the ones who are getting affected by that terrorism, first and foremost, before anybody else.
Right.
And these people that we're talking about, those middle class professionals, are just like any other middle-class professional anywhere in the world.
Now, how are Pakistani people helping, who are in cities who are okay, helping the flood victims?
I don't know a single person who is not involved in some kind of flood relief right now. Literally. I mean, and I have to say this. As a Pakistani-American, I have to give it to the Pakistanis. They've been through so many crises that they already know, they're wired, that the minute something like this happens, they'll just roll up their sleeves and start going.
Right.
They're donating, they're viral, they're appealing for funds, they're, you know, whatever they can do, they are doing there. But what I'm worried about is that it is such a mega disaster that we're not getting the international coverage that we need. Because this is not going to go away in 2 weeks. This is 3-4 years of infrastructure destroyed. And we cannot afford, as human beings, we cannot afford that those 20 million people who are affected right now and displaced, 6 million of them, the UN has announced, are in danger of starving in the next 2 weeks. How are we going to keep that in our conscience if we don't all roll up our sleeves and do something?
And it's not enough for Pakistanis, although everybody is getting out and doing what they can. But as you were telling me before we went on the air, everybody in the cities is bringing food to the countryside,
yeah,
to the point where there's going to be food shortages in the cities.
Absolutely. This is what I got today from a phone call. Somebody called me. They said, because we are involved in so much of, you know, individual donations going out and people are buying off of the racks there, that within a week you're going to run out of supplies and the urban areas will be hit. So where's the food? Where's the humanitarian aid that we need the world to actually be coming up with?
Now, are there foreign aid donations? In other words, there's insufficient media coverage. I don't know about Europe. Has the coverage been better in Europe?
BBC has been doing a lot. The BBC has been doing a lot. I have to give them credit for that. The UN has really jumped in because, of course, they just visited right now also. They've put out a plea. The number that I saw was 459 million to begin with. And unfortunately, only 102 million has been pledged so far. Just to put it in comparison, I think within 2 weeks of Haiti, they had raised a billion.
Right.
Haiti is a much smaller country. Pakistan is a much vaster country. It's almost 160 million people. This is, you know, a third of the country underwater. I mean, I can't even fathom it myself,
right,
until people call me late night and they describe what's actually going on. One very young activist who I know very well, he had studied here in the U.S. and he had just gone back to Pakistan. He called me up yesterday and gave me the most devastating image, which I think is going to haunt me for the rest of my life, that he saw people eating grass. You can't get away from it. You just can't.
I think it's so important for Americans, I mean, for everybody, but here we are in the United States, we're Americans, to put aside whatever stereotypes we have. I think, for example, the word tribal brings up stereotypes, and Navajo people are tribal.
I'm tribal.
Our Pueblo people are tribal. You're tribal.
Yeah, I'm actually really tribal, as I was telling you before, because from my father's side, I'm from Balochistan. And from my mother's side, I'm from Afghanistan, from the tribes. So we're totally tribal. But do I sound tribal to you?
Well, and, yeah, and what does that mean? And is it bad?
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that has unfortunately been part of a kind of not very well or clearly thought out public dialogue,
exactly,
which is that tribal people have been killing each other for untold millennia.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the end of the thing. And then you dismiss a whole universe of people.
No, you're dismissing human beings.
Yeah.
It's everything I have realized, at least what little time I've spent on this planet, is gray. And in a lot of these stereotypes, we make it so black and white,
right,
that we forget the grayness in the middle.
So, meanwhile, here we are in the United States. Okay, huge amounts of land and infrastructure are basically gone or underwater in Pakistan. food is already at a shortage. It's going to be a much bigger shortage soon. Poor, middle class, every kind of person is being terribly affected. And there's also a danger of waterborne
diseases.
Epidemics.
They are very worried. The UN actually just put out an appeal for this yesterday, that they're thinking we're going to have an epidemic of cholera and hepatitis, which, as you know, are, you know, ravaging kind of diseases and can quickly turn into a complete epidemic overnight.
You know, this is, I have to say, having done just last week this series on climate change, these are exactly both the kind of diseases and the kind of extreme weather events that have been predicted by climate scientists and public health experts.
Exactly. And if you, you know, if you're interested in the environment, this is something to look at. Because there are reports now coming out that the Chinese flooding that's happening, as well as the Russian fires which are happening, and the flooding in Pakistan is all interrelated.
Right.
And I don't think they have enough hard data on it yet, but definitely the headlines I've seen in the past, you know, couple of days, that all three factors factor into this climate change.
It's interesting also that very few of our celebrities that usually do disaster relief publicity in a very large scale and, in fact, you know, help to bring a lot of donations in.
Absolutely.
They've been strangely silent.
Totally silent. The only person who's actually made a statement was Angelina Jolie, who made a statement yesterday in the UK. She said that she is, because she is the ambassador for UNHCR and has been to Pakistan a number of times. During the earthquake, the 2005 earthquake, she made a statement yesterday saying that she is absolutely in touch with UNHCR about the devastating situation. She's talking to Holbrooke every day, and she is planning to go. Okay, she's just waiting for the right time and, you know, to actually be effective in trying to raise funds. But why we're not seeing the celebrities right now is because there is no coverage in the U.S. media. I mean, I watch the news every single day religiously just to see all the different channels about what they're doing on the flooding. Just 3 days ago did they start putting it in the main news. Okay, ABC, World News started picking it up. CBS, Katie Couric did something on it yesterday. CNN apparently put it as the last thing in their headline news, which really shocked me. PBS has been doing stuff, but what they're not doing is making the announcement to donate, which was happening during the Haiti funds.
Right.
They're just giving you the news. People are flooded. 20 million are displaced. The UN has called it a complete crisis. But they're not going forward and saying UNHCR has started a text messaging service to donate $10. You can text 50555. And donate $10 immediately to UNHCR, which goes to the floods. They're not putting, there's no ticker.
Right. So you can text, if you text the numbers 50555, $10 will be donated. Mm-hmm. There will be some delay in that money actually getting to people who need it.
Yes. I mean, this is why we picked Mercy Corps and why we started this whole campaign, Relief for Pakistan.
Because Mercy Corps is donating immediately.
It's immediate. They're giving the funds immediately to the people on the ground. They're getting clean water to these people. They're, you know, they're there. It is the first response, which is what the most important thing in any emergency is the first response. So that's what Mercy Corps is doing, and that's why we handpicked them and, you know, did a lot of due diligence. These women really did a lot of due diligence. There are two companies behind it. One is the Pakistani Peace Builders, and the other one is MLS Social Vision. Pakistani Peace Builders, just 2 weeks ago, held the first Sufi music festival in New York City at Union Square. And they got, it was, I saw the pictures, it was about 6,000 people who showed up, bang in the middle of New York City to listen to Pakistani Sufi music.
Right, right.
And it was crazy. A wonderful, positive response and a positive, you know, image of Pakistan to kind of negate the narrative of terrorism and what have you. So they are absolutely behind this. And what we are also hoping is that you will not just go to the page and donate. Whatever you choose to donate at this point will be appreciated. If it's $5, if it's $10, if it's $20, I don't care. Just give something. But what I would personally appeal for is that once you've put in your donation, take that page and mail it to your entire email list. Because that's what we're hoping we're going to start tapping into. For people to start understanding that there is at least one Pakistani in their network. If I am going to be that one Pakistani for all your listeners today, then I am that one Pakistani.
Right.
Do it for me.
Right.
And it doesn't take that long. Copy the page, email it to everybody you know. Let's get the ball rolling.
And the way I think about this also is on any given day or any given week,
yeah,
many of us, not all of us, but many of us are going to waste $10.
We are.
That's something
I
that
know
we
I
don't
do.
Really need
yeah.
that much.
Yeah.
Give it to the website.
Exactly.
It's relief, the number 4, Pakistan.com, relieffor Pakistan.com. Aisha Khan, is there anything else that you want to tell our listeners before we go?
Well, one, I want to thank you again for having me. Okay. Secondly, I'm hoping someone out there knows some celebrities. After all, this is Santa Fe. We are the biggest filmmaking, New Mexico filmmaking.
Right.
Out
New Mexico's
there.
Burgeoning film is
burgeoning
industry is
film
rife
industry
with celebrities.
Is right here. If anybody is listening out there, we really, really seriously feel we need some celebrity endorsements at this point. Somebody to stand up. You can contact us on the Relief for Pakistan page. Or if there is a celebrity actually listening, can you just make a statement and appeal for funds? It really does have an effect and it really does help because it immediately becomes news, right? And it does go out on the wires, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm hoping that since it is New Mexico, and we do have a lot of big movies filming here all the time, that somebody will come out of the woodworks and start contacting us for this appeal.
And meanwhile, for all the rest of us non-celebrities, tell your friends, activate your mailing list, and go and look at the pictures, too.
Go and look at the pictures. On Boston.com, the Boston Globe's website, they've done a huge pictorial. You'll get the message. And you will understand that, you know, this is a mega disaster of biblical proportions at this point. And how do we get coverage to it? And one other thing I just want to add, because I've shown 2 movies here now at the Santa Fe Film Festival.
Yeah, Lifting the Veil and Made in
Pakistan. Lifting the Veil and Made in Pakistan. And I have not felt more supported by any other festival or any other community than I did in Santa Fe. We were sold out for both films. We've played here extensively. People have written us wonderful messages. So I know my audience is listening, you know, because I know they're there. I've met them. So I'm hoping that after having seen those films, you have a different picture of Pakistan. And you know me.
Is there an email, phone number, any other information you want to give besides the relieffor Pakistan.com website?
Yes. Actually, what I'll give you is our own personal email for our company in case you need to get in touch. It's Indus Valley, INDUS Valley, VALLEY, at mac.com. Mac is MAC.com.
Indus Valley at Mac.com.
Exactly. And if anybody's on Twitter, I Twitter through Indus Valley on Twitter, INDUS Valley, VALLEY. And of course, you can find us again in the same with the same word, Indus Valley Productions on Facebook. If you cannot find Relief for Pakistan in case or whatever, you know.
And if you can't find any of that, come to the Santa Fe Baking Company.
And ask Mary Charlotte how to find
and
me.
And I will help you.
Exactly. Thanks so much.
Okay. So. Aisha Khan, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome Marcia Keegan. She is an award-winning photographer. She was given a Lifetime Achievement Award from the 8 Northern Pueblos and received the 2010 Governor's Award for Outstanding New Mexican Women. She's the author of many books. Her new book is actually the 40th anniversary edition of the book Taos Pueblo and Its Sacred Blue Lake, and she will be having an exhibit of her work, both from this book and from many others, a very large body of work, at the Silver Sun Gallery on Canyon Road here in Santa Fe. The opening is tomorrow, August 20th, from 5 to 8 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a wonderful book. It's one of the few books that you've done in black and white. And you started it, well, you did it, the first edition, 40 years ago to celebrate the victory after a very long battle to reclaim the sacred blue lake in Taos and the land around it.
Yes. And when I think about it, I'm amazed that I was able to, 40 years ago, explain to a publisher in New York, Simon & Schuster, who the Indians were, where Taos was, why it was an important event, and historically why I should do a book. And
it was a different era.
It was completely. And I was talking, I was educating these editors and these people that had never been out of New York.
Exactly.
When I look back on it, it was amazing that I was able to explain. And then when I did go there and for the celebration and photograph, it was a momentous occasion for me as well as, of course, everyone. It was just something that I always will remember. It was, everyone was crying, dancing, laughing. I just was thrilled that I was a part of it. And then, so that book was published in 1971 by Simon & Schuster, and then Clearlight, my publishing company here in Santa Fe, did a 20th anniversary, and then that was in 1991. And then they called me, and at first I thought they said it's a 50th anniversary, and I was really feeling old. Then luckily they said it was the 40th anniversary. And so this book is better than the other two books because it has a lot of new information, and I'm really thrilled about the book. It's really a lot of information with quotes from people at the Pueblo, including the governor and the war chief. And it's really their book. And in fact, they gave me the seal, and I'm having it on the cover of the book for the 40th anniversary.
The Pueblo seal?
Yes.
Nice.
And royalties are going back to the Pueblo.
So let's talk for a moment about the Sacred Blue Lake. What was the whole story? When did Taos Pueblo lose that land in the first place?
Teddy Roosevelt, and he, when he was president, he made this a national park. And so for 65 years, the elders went to Washington and tried to get the Blue Lake back.
Now, this was a sacred lake that was used for ceremonial purposes.
Yes, and it still is.
Yeah.
And they go on pilgrimages there. They put prayer sticks down. It is absolutely a sacred place, plus the land around it. And so it was, for 65 years, they kept going to Washington, and the government kept wanting to give them money for it, and they said, no amount of money. So it was a turning point in 1971 when Nixon finally signed the bill. It was a turning point for not only for Taos Pueblo, but for a lot of tribes getting their land back.
And that was, I mean, an interesting time because Indians were starting to get, and not only, as you say, not only Taos Pueblo, get some land back. The civil rights movements, the various civil rights movements were going on at the same time, and there was sort of a sense in the country of righting a lot of past wrongs.
Right. But I didn't put Nixon's picture in the first book or the second book, but with maturity on my part, and appreciation
what
Nixon
did. Well, you just
didn't
like him?
Well, I didn't. I didn't like him. And so, but then with, like I say, with maturity and with awareness of what he really did do, I have a wonderful picture of him signing the bill with the elders in the book and a quote from him. I mean, what he did say at that time about why he felt that this was a momentous time and how it would change for other tribes. And so that's going to be in this book, and it wasn't in the other two books.
Very nice.
But and I have a lot of wonderful new things in this last book.
I know. I mean, I remember, you know, I was a kid when Nixon was president, but he looks like a flaming liberal from contemporary perspective.
I know. It's amazing how, you know, when we think about, he really didn't do hardly anything compared to what Cheney and Bush did. I mean, it's...
he signed the... Well, anyway, we won't talk about Nixon too much here. But one of the things that was so interesting for me in reading your book was the way that, you know, you think, oh, you give over the land to the Forest Service, it'll be treated nicely. Well, the Forest Service, as you write, saw the area around Blue Lake as potential timber sales and a place to give grazing permits, and the Taos Indians saw it as a sacred place.
Yes, and so it was really horrifying to them to go there and see that their prayers, sticks and everything were, you know, trampled on, and they had to get a permit to kill a deer to feed their family. I mean, it was a whole different scene, and so it rightfully what came back.
We're talking to Marcia Keegan. Her new book is called Taos Pueblo and Its Sacred Blue Lake, and the exhibition tomorrow of this and much more work is at the Silver Sun Gallery on Canyon Road. We'll be talking more about that in a couple of minutes. There's a nice quotation in the book about Richard Nixon and about this whole transaction of returning the land.
Yes. Many of the people from the Pueblo, I asked them to write statements about why they felt the Blue Lake coming back to the Pueblo was important. And one of the things that was that is in the book is from Rick Romasito, who's a Taos tribal member and also a Taos news writer. And he said, it was simply the right thing to do. Richard Nixon, for all his faults, recognized that, so did members of Congress who helped pass the landmark legislation. For that we shall all be eternally grateful. But truth be told, it wasn't their pen to paper that really allowed this to happen. It was the hand of justice that moved their hearts.
Very nice.
Yeah, and there's some
wonderful... a lot of citizen movements and a lot of writers and journalists in the media who made all of this happen.
Yes. I mean, I was, as a young woman, an activist and have always been for all Native Americans. So I was involved with this movement, and the national... churches became involved, and Frank Waters, who wrote the first foreword for the book in 71, he was a close friend of mine even when I was in college, and he did the famous book Man Who Killed a Deer, which was about how a Taos Indian went to jail because he had not had a permit, and that really helped to make people realize what the problem was.
We're talking to Marcia Keegan. Let's talk for a few minutes about Taos Pueblo. This is a place that's been continuously inhabited for 800 years. It's almost unfathomable to so many of us. I mean, we think we've been here in Santa Fe for 400 years, and that seems like forever. Taos Pueblo is twice as old.
And maybe even older.
Yes.
It's a wonderful traditional Pueblo, with the 19 pueblos here in New Mexico. And I was just very lucky to meet the elders at this time. The book is black and white, and the original publisher, Simon Schuster, had me do it in black and white. And most of the people in my book from that time have passed away because they were elders. And but I really feel very lucky that I was a part of the community. And this new book is a lot of new people that were children at the time that the original book came out.
I love that you have a kind of a 40-year history with, or more than 40-year history with this Pueblo, because the governors and elders and all the people in charge right now were running around your ankles when you were taking these first set of pictures.
Some of them weren't born.
Yeah.
But Tony Reyna, who is a very good friend and has been a governor many times, he's 94, and he was a part of the original. And what's also interesting that I did not know that is in this new book is that Gilbert Suaza, who was, I think, in his late 20s at the time, he got a petition of all the youth and the children from the Pueblo, because the Congress said only the old people are interested in this.
Yeah, the opponents to giving back Blue Lake said, oh, well, this is just about the elders. The youth don't care.
Right. And Gilbert made a petition, and he got over 400 youth to sign this petition and went to Washington with the elders to show that the youth was very much involved. And so a lot of the people that were youth at the time, like Marie Reyna, Tony Reyna's daughter, who's the director of Uhuna Art Center, she was 10 at the time, and she said that she still remembers how angry she was when she heard that they thought that she and her friends weren't interested. So it is really something that sort of is the glue that makes this Pueblo so special. And it is really... the water from the Blue Lake comes down in between each side of the Pueblo. And this is like pure water, whereas it was endangered when the Forest Service had it.
Yeah, and as you write in the book, I mean, there were... the land was used for grazing, the springs got muddied, the deer were driven away, the food and medicinal plants were depleted, and there was log cutting and the whole thing. It must have been a mess when the land was finally given back.
Yes, I think it was. And but it's today as sacred as it was previously.
We're talking to Marcia Keegan. So tell us a little bit, I mean, you're one of the... I guess, outsiders who's been closer to the daily life of Taos Pueblo than most of us. What is daily life like there in contrast to, urban life in Santa Fe? What do people do? How do they live?
Well, they're still very traditional, and in the Pueblo proper, it still doesn't have electricity or running water, because they want to be closer to the land, and they feel they can be. But they also... are a Pueblo that is open to tourists at certain times, not after hours, but basically they have a place where tourists can go during certain hours during the week.
Yeah, I've been there a bunch of times and see this architecture, which is unique in this area.
Very unique. And so Taos and Acoma Pueblos are really the only ones that have a situation where the tourists can go and see the Pueblo. So it is open in that respect for people to see, and it is a historic place that has been recognized on the National Register for its unusual architecture.
Now, do people who live in Taos Pueblo make their living there, in other words, grow their food and so on?
Many of them do, but then there's artists. And then also they go in town and have regular jobs. But it's very private and active with their ceremonies. One of the things that is in the book that was the original, I was much younger, and with some Taos friends, I climbed to the top of the water tower and took pictures from above. And the governor recently thought that I had taken it from a plane. And I said, no, I climbed to the top of the water tower and took the picture. But the water tower isn't there anymore. So a lot of people didn't realize how I had taken that picture.
Right, right.
But so, I have wonderful memories of taking pictures there and eating meals and having, some wonderful times.
Now, this is a book of, as you said, black and white, as we've talked about, black and white photographs. Almost all the rest of your work and the work that we will see at the Silver Sun Gallery on Canyon Road is in color. Why did you do this book in black and white?
Well, originally, Simon & Schuster made me do it in black and white.
Why?
I guess for expense reasons.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, but therefore I have the early pictures in black and white, so I've continued with a black and white book. And I basically am a color photographer, but this book is very sweet, and I like it in black and white, and I'm going to have a limited edition of pictures, a few pictures from the book that will be at the exhibit as well.
So let's talk about some of the work that's going to be in the exhibit. You have various bodies of work, including a lot of work in Tibet, and you've been with the Dalai Lama and done an incredible set of work there, and a lot of the books that you publish at Clear Light Publishers are about that, but just as much is Native American work in the Southwest.
Yes, and as with my Pueblo People book, I've photographed all 19 Pueblos, and these, all the pictures in all my books are friends, so I know their names and I know them personally.
And that makes the photograph so much more personal and friendly and kind of open.
And as you know, you have to get permission, so it's not getting people off guard or sneaking a picture. They're all pictures of friends, and so you can see that they're friends. And so the exhibit will be a room full of all the different Pueblos, basically, as well as Taos.
Marcia, how did you become a photographer in the first place?
Well, I got a degree from the University of New Mexico in journalism. And I worked for the Albuquerque Tribune and then the Albuquerque Journal.
And as a photographer?
No, as a writer.
Oh, okay.
I had never taken a course in photography, but for the Albuquerque Journal, after graduating from UNM, I would go on assignment with a photographer and do the story, and then I would invariably come back and the pictures weren't what I saw, and so I just thought I should just take pictures myself. And I learned, and I was lucky, it came naturally to me. And so my stories were smaller and smaller, and my pictures were larger and larger. And then I went to New York and studied photography, and that's where I really became involved as a strong photographer. But I came back constantly to New Mexico. I was born in Oklahoma and raised in Oklahoma and was used to powwows. So when I first came and saw a sacred dance, actually my first dance was the Shalako at Zuni Pueblo. And when I saw the sacred dances and saw how special and spiritual the ceremonies were at the Pueblos, I really became involved. And that's when I wanted to share my knowledge and my photographs with others.
Now, I would imagine there's this whole process of getting permission to take photographs and gaining trust of the people that you're photographing that you had to go through.
Yes, and I'm told I'm the only person in history that's photographed all 19 Pueblos. And I think that I've been very honored, but I think they think of me as their family photographer. So Robert Tenorio just had some, his niece just had two little twins, and they brought them up for me to photograph, and they're just darling. And so now I'm told that when they're trying to get them to smile, they say, "Marcia's going to be taking your picture."
That's amazing. So, you really are family photographer. Yeah. When family occasions happen, do you photograph their weddings
and
things like that?
Yeah. Oh, yes, of course. And I also, they know and trust me. They know that I will not photograph anything that is not something they want to be photographed.
Right.
So I think that those boundaries are very clear, and I have kept with those boundaries. And that's another reason why I think I have been able to take pictures of dances and things. But also, recently there's been more of people not being allowed to photograph dances. And I was doing that for many, many years.
So you were lucky enough to do it, and we're lucky enough to have those books at our disposal. Just quickly, do you see a link between the work you've done in the Southwest and the work that you've done in Tibet?
Very much so, and I've been working for a number of years about the similarities, and hopefully that book will be coming out because it's been on the drawing board for many years.
What do you see as some of the similarities?
Oh, everything. That not only the landscape, the portraits, the symbols, sand paintings and mandalas, deer dances. That's a whole nother...
Yeah, well, that's another interview. But I was thinking of it because at the beginning of the book that we've been talking about, the new book, well, which is the 40th edition version of Taos Pueblo and its Sacred Blue Lake, there was a statement at the beginning that the philosophical grounding of the Taos way of life and the way of looking at the world is that the relationships among people, between people and the environment, and between people and their higher spirit is all pretty much the same thing. And that has real echoes in, I mean, I've been talking about this lately, but I was in Bali last year, and that is exactly the same as what I saw in Balinese Hinduism.
Yes. Well, with Tibetan Buddhism as well as the traditional Indian way, is everything is sacred. So the Sacred Blue Lake is a wonderful lake, but also all things are sacred within the Pueblo thinking.
We're talking to Marcia Keegan. So this exhibit of photographs is a wonderful thing for you because you've been exhibited all over the world. The last one exhibit that you had was in Singapore, but you haven't been exhibited here very much lately. And so now this is a terrific occasion, and there will be cibachrome prints, which we don't see much of anymore. Lots of nice color work.
Yes, you can't make dye transfers, and cibachromes have gone by the wayside. You can't make them anymore. And so this is really one-of-a-kind opportunity. These are cibachrome prints, all of them in color, and then my black and white of Taos. But I'm really excited. Silver Sun is a wonderful gallery, and it's on Canyon Road right across from Compound.
And it's at 656 Canyon Road.
Yes. And they're going to have music and food.
Music and food are good. And that will be tomorrow, August 20th, from 5 to 8, the Silver Sun Gallery on Canyon Road. And the exhibit goes on through the end of September. Once again, Marcia Keegan, award-winning photographer, also publisher of Clear Light Books. And we look forward to seeing you tomorrow night.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us and friend us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's wonderful award-winning news team. And after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Adios.